The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, it's brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives you expert solutions for your transactional banking needs. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show. South Africa confirms the first case of coronavirus in KZN imported from Italy. We'll talk to three chief executives of three South African companies about how they're going to cope. Some Chabalala about results today, but also he's got a big branch network. He's got, 35, 40,000 employees in South Africa, significant number of people. What plans do you have? Suntum, that's quite interesting to look at their results. Not only do they have to deal with hail and drought and all kinds of other things and car crashes because we are idiots on the road, but they've also now got their investment portfolios that they invest the money they collect from you in premiums in stock markets, and suddenly stock markets are falling on their faces. And then Dr. Ryan Noach as to what health insurers are going to be doing when it comes to facilitating testing, to getting people hospitalized if necessary. So yeah, there's lots to come on The Money Show. Plus Warren Ingram on how to invest in this time of, can we call it fear? No, uncertainty, deep uncertainty. And Pavlo Fatidis talking small business.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
You do wonder if the business rescue practitioners at SAA are going, oh, and there's another thing we've got to worry about, because Flybe, it's a UK airline, collapsed today. A huge collapse in travel demand in the UK. And this airline, which got bailed out by the government in the UK last year at some point, becomes the first big corporate casualty, and they're saying, of the coronavirus outbreak. That's sort of cost 2,500 jobs. And of course, lots of regional economy is going to get hit because Flybe, which is a bit like Air Link, I suppose, in South Africa, simply couldn't keep going. Well, like Nedbank earlier this week, Standard Bank also reporting that its customers are struggling to pay it back when they borrow money, so profits are under pressure. It was helped by 100 branch closures. It's been cutting costs and did manage to grow 1%, below expectations, but it's still a positive number. Sim Chabalala is the chief executive of Standard Bank. He joins us this evening. We're in recession, Sim Chabalala. I suppose it should come as no surprise that the banking environment has got a lot more difficult.
Bruce, undoubtedly, the country was down 0.2% last year, and like you say, the second half of the year we're in recession. It felt like we're in recession. It continues to feel that way, and you see it in the results that have been reported so far.
Yeah, no, we certainly saw it in the Nedbank results. It comes through in your results too. People borrow money, and then suddenly when it comes time to kind of use the term pay back the money, households are stretched, and it's really difficult.
They are, Bruce, but do you mind if I spend a minute or two just talking a little bit about these numbers?
Sure.
The first point is our home loans, which is the largest portfolio, was up 6%. Sorry, it was up 4%. So it was up 4%. Our vehicle and asset finance, is up 6%. And unsecured lending, so personal unsecured lending, was up 12%. It's important to unpack the dynamics of what's happening here, because like you say, our credit loss ratio is at 68 basis points. It is still below our target range of between 70 and 100. And you ought to ask, who are these borrowers? And why are we not as concerned as you seem to be? Because there's an argument to say, well, we're lending to people that are earning between 350,000 rand a month and above. Those would be sort of upper middle income people. Their debt to disposable income ratio over the years has been declining, and they're the biggest drivers of the decline in the country's debt to disposable income ratio. They are able to repay their debts because the ratio of their income to their debts has been improving. It's at around 9%. And so these people are actually able to meet the obligations that they fall due. What you've seen, however, is as we've been lending more and as we've been increasing our lending, our provisions are increasing. But it doesn't follow from that the book has become bad.
Is it not the beginning of a downward cycle, though? I suppose that's my concern, is that for years and years and years, we've been wondering when South African consumers are going to start struggling. And in this recessionary environment, it feels like this could be the beginning of a down cycle, and quite a long down cycle. My sense from what you're saying is you don't think that is true.
We may be in a down cycle. The environment will be tough. It will be a recession. But I'm just saying that we've managed our lending books very tightly and very strictly. And that's off the back of our own models. It's off the back of the National Credit Act and its amendments in 2013, which actually increased affordability assessments, the rules in respect of affordability assessments, which made banks much stricter in their credit extension. And Bruce, we're very far from 2009, when the debt to disposable income ratio was around 85%.
No, it was crazy. Those were the crazy days, and everyone's been a lot more conservative since then. Should the Reserve Bank be a bit more active in cutting interest rates just to alleviate pressure on this economy?
I think they're very likely to do so, Bruce. The large countries have done so. The US has done so. Europe and a lot of other countries are considering it. The Chinese are considering a monetary easing as well. Firstly. Secondly, our inflation rate is at all-time lows. And thirdly, if one listens to the governor, I'm sure that the members of the MPC will be sympathetic to that view.
You set a very clear policy out today on the future of coal financing and coal projects. This stuff can get very, very technical. In simple terms, are you closing the taps on coal, or just turning them a quarter of a turn?
No, we're going to follow a very disciplined approach to lending to coal and to thermal mines. We are going to apply the principles of the Paris Accord. We're going to focus on Article 4, which basically says that countries that have not had the opportunity to develop at the same rate as the developed world must be given the opportunity to develop without having a negative impact on the environment. We'll apply the Equator Principles, and we'll make sure that there's a balance between the environmental impact of this kind of activity versus the social impact, which has to do with jobs and social security.
I mean, it's such a difficult balance to strike. It really is, because we've got some filthy industries in South Africa which are very damaging to the environment. At the same time, you cut off funding to some of these industries and we end up in all kinds of other trouble. How are you going to be dealing as a business with the coronavirus? We've seen the first confirmed case in South Africa. Do you have contingency plans across I think you've got about 600 branches. You must have at least 35,000 people working across the networks of Standard Bank in South Africa. Do you have a plan?
Yes, Bruce. In fact, our challenge is even bigger than just the South African challenge. We operate in 20 countries on the continent, and we also have people based in China. And if I may just start with the people based in China, they're no longer attending at the office. They're working from home. And those that were out of the country are either operating from London or Johannesburg. They've been quarantined, and we are quite satisfied that they are safe. And we've put in place protocols on how to communicate and how to work. And would you believe me if I told you that they've not missed a beat? They continue to function, productivity continues, and they're interacting with clients, and that is continuing.
So maybe this is the future of work. People never have to travel again. Nobody ever has to go to an office or take up a car parking space again. Maybe this is the future of work at Standard Bank, Sim.
Bruce, on a serious note, it's testing our disaster recovery. It's testing the equipment we use. It's testing using the platforms we've got for communication. We've got a system, for example, called Blue Jeans, where people don't have to travel. They can talk to each other through these platforms. We're thinking about how to deal with our dealing room. Where should our dealers be sitting? We've got all of these plans in place, and we will trigger them when it's necessary. So in other words, we've got contingency plans. As I said this morning, we've done thorough scenario analyses, and we know what to do in each of those scenarios.
Have you looked at what happens with cash? I mean, you guys take in cash, you dispense cash all the time, some new notes, some old notes. There were some concerns that a great method of spreading the condition of coronavirus can be done with banknotes. People do all kinds of disgusting things with money. Do you have a mechanism to deal with that?
Bruce, at a high level, we're in touch with the World Health Organization. We're in touch with security experts and security firms. And we've got systems and processes in place to cover all the eventualities, whether it be in respect of cash, our buildings, our branches, the movement of our people, the movement of goods. And we've got thorough plans that we've thought through. I mean, we can't think of every eventuality,
no, of course,
but we've covered most of the major operational risks.
Sim Chabalala, Chief Executive at Standard Bank, thank you. Tonight on The Money Show, we'll talk to Gary Boyson about the Standard Bank results today. We also saw results coming out of Momentum. They seem to have turned a big corner. There was a huge drive to stabilize Momentum, which was a little wobbly about 18 months, 2 years ago. So we'll pick up on that in just a moment. There were some words of wisdom from the Reserve Bank Governor today. I asked Sim Chabalala that question on purpose because Lesitja Khanyako making a speech this week at the University of the Free State, and he was saying, in conclusion, we in South Africa have to reform, talking about economic reforms. It will involve some pain, but the longer we delay, the more painful it will be. We could tell ourselves comforting stories about how there are pain-free alternatives, but these narratives are misleading. We have spent a lot of time searching for easy options, and these schemes don't stand up to scrutiny. Here's what we can really do about mitigating the pain of necessary reform. We've got to take the edge off the interest rate with the interest rate tool, so he's implying there that more cuts are coming. Provided we have low inflation, and if the country risk comes down, we can keep rates low and maybe go lower. I've not ever heard him speak like this before. So that was an interesting point that he made. He says we also need to devise a credible plan for making things better again. In macroeconomics, as in so many things, it's not about where you are, it's about where you are going. And South Africa for years has been drifting into crisis. This has been the South African story before. We have in the past been able to change the narrative. South Africa's many friends, there's a lot of money out there desperate for good economies to invest in. We can be one of those winning countries again. The words of the Reserve Bank Governor, Lesitja Khanyako. But yes, I do like it. It's not about where you are so much as to where you're going. We've been going to the wrong place for an awfully long time. Are you feeling as confident as the Reserve Bank Governor seems to be feeling that to you? We, like many companies in South Africa, perhaps are finally turning one of those corners.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Gary Boyson, he is a director at Rand Swiss. And I don't know where to start, really. The world today went mad again. Markets around the globe went down sharply. US markets down about 3%. The JSE ended up only 9 points, but still, we ended up in a sea of down.
Yeah, I think it was just a function of when our market happened to close. Because
good timing.
Really,
good timing.
It's just been oscillating between total panic around the impact that the coronavirus is potentially going to have, and then suddenly this like strong FOMO that you've missed the bottom and that you're not going to get back in time, and markets rushing back up. So it's certainly an emotional roller coaster to be involved in financial markets at the moment.
Absolutely. But there was a forecast today, 2020 global growth, US growth, China growth forecasts all being revised downwards. We've got OPEC trying to cut oil production, California declaring a state of emergency around coronavirus, South Africa though, yes, you know, our current account deficit narrowed to its lowest levels in a decade. Business confidence in February picked up a little bit, according to the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry. It's just like nobody seems to know what they're thinking or feeling right now.
Yeah, no, it's a very difficult world. Because I think it's because of the amount of uncertainty that the coronavirus is bringing into it. No one really knows how to position themselves. And I mean, you look at the current account numbers today, and yes, it looks much, much better. But the point is, what is the next set going to look like? This is not taking into account the impact yet. And when that starts to filter through into the numbers, we've had some of the more forward-looking numbers, the likes of the PMI starting to show what's happening in China.
And that was ugly.
And it was ugly. It was really ugly. So I think it's going to take time for this to work through the system. And at the moment, you know, everyone in, I suppose, a position of power that you speak to about what their response is, you know, corporate executives, etc., they refuse to be drawn on it. They say it's a lot of unknowns. We kind of, you know, doing what we should be doing, but we won't commit one way or the other if this is going to be incredibly serious or it's just a blip and everyone kind of relax.
I like what Sim Chabalala had to say. I mean, we've got their plans. They've been able to practice on small teams in places places like China, sort of get and test the mechanisms to see if things will work. What did you think of those Standard Bank results? They are growing their lending. They are expanding their books. They had a big write-off in a venture that they run with ICBC. ICBC, I think, is what, 60%. They've got 40%. They had to take a big knock on an oil plant that exploded in America.
Yeah, so looking at that transaction, I mean, they were really trying to create, an emerging market lender. And, they've had to take impairments there. And I think they're now putting in measures to kind of right-size the business. Overall, Standard Bank is going through, it's an era of change. The banking industry itself is changing. I mean, the actual headline numbers, they missed the estimates slightly. So it was flat but slightly down. And I think that's to be expected given the very difficult operating environment that we have. Banks are always going to be a function of economic activity. And if you're not getting that economic activity through, they're going to struggle. But really, I think what's interesting in the results is just the speed at which the group is trying to change things. So trying to change from a technological point of view. I mean, they've had retrenchments. They are closing branches. They're moving into a more digital age, which I think it's the second biggest bank by market capitalization, but biggest bank by assets in South Africa. It's a huge task to turn a ship around of that size. And I think they're making very, very solid progress, but it's going to be slow going. And I think, they mentioned the competition from much smaller, much more nimble players that are out there nipping at their heels.
I was at a conference this morning, a digital banking conference run by Business Tech. And I mean, it was just, the guys are so hungry. And you're watching the growth that's coming through in Time Digital. It's in a different market segment. It's not a segment necessarily Standard Bank wants to play in. But the point is there are players in there and they are eager to do business. Momentum, 18 months ago, looked in a sorry state. It's in a much better shape today.
No, I thought the Momentum results were absolutely fantastic. I think they're really, really, they're currently going through a process of, they call it the reset and grow. And really the reset side of the process is almost complete. And they're moving more towards the grow side of it. They struggled a little bit in their corporate business. That was always their kind of star performer in years gone by. But it's coming off a high base, so that was hit a little bit. But certainly the retail business, where they're really focusing on the independent financial advisors to broaden that network, that seems to be gaining more and more traction as I think they improve the quality of their products. So overall, it was very decent. I mean, they managed to raise their dividend by 14%, headline earnings up by 10%. And we are just starting to see these pockets of excellence develop in South Africa. And I think it's great.
I've drawn attention to it before, but ShopRite's expanding, Spur's expanding. There are businesses growing despite the fact that we're sitting in a recession.
Absolutely. And you look at it and you see these companies that, again, some of the numbers, if you really dig into the metrics, like they are under pressure in certain segments of their business. But, if you put those in context of the overall market, they're actually taking market share from many other players, even though the numbers are coming down. On a relative basis, they're performing even better.
Wouldn't it be nice if we had economic growth and then they could grow?
Oh, that would be fantastic.
And take market share and yes.
And I suppose the way they finished their presentation this morning was just around the opportunity that they're looking at in India as well. And I just hope that some of these, great South African companies, I mean, we want them to grow as shareholders. Absolutely, we want them to grow. But I mean, when they're finding more opportunities in other emerging markets, it's sad. I mean, there's so much potential here and they should, and like you say, if we can just get a little bit of growth and perhaps not such a constrained electricity supply, it would certainly help.
Hey, look, we haven't had load shedding for 10 days now.
Excellent.
Jeez, come on, what's wrong with you? Suntum with results out today. Lots of claims, but this is, I mean, if you're going to look for really well-run South African businesses, there are few machines that are better oiled than this one.
And it's interesting. So, looking at Suntum, very different from a Momentum or an MMI where it's a lot of it is focused on the investment business and the long-term insurance. This is really a short-term insurance player. And, headline earnings were flat, I mean, down 1%. And part of that was just because it was a difficult year for short-term claims. I mean, there were fires in the Western Cape, floods in KwaZulu-Natal, and, people have been claiming. So it's impacted numbers a little bit. But overall, a decent set of results. Also increasing their dividend by 8%. So, if you drill through those headline numbers, actually still a very, very solid business.
Gary Boyson from Rand Swiss. Lizzie Lombrecht, the chief executive at Suntum, will join us in the next half hour. Plus, we'll talk to Dr. Ryan Noach, who is the CEO of Discovery Health, about what they are doing and what they're promising they will do in the face of this COVID-19 coronavirus. Pick up on that in the next half hour.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives you expert solutions for your transactional banking needs. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Bruce Whitfield on 702.
There's an old saying, when it rains, it pours. Insurers can go for years without significant claims, and others, the claims never seem to stop. Lizzie Lambrecht is the chief executive of Santam, and last year was one of those years where the claims didn't seem to stop. A whole bunch of events all coming like buses all at the same time, Lizzie.
2019 was a year of mixed fortunes for us, actually. In the first half, yes, we had lots of catastrophes and many claims, but the second half was much kinder to us, enabling us to actually deliver a reasonable underwriting result for the year.
The underwriting result was good, but the claims were high and overall earnings were therefore impacted. Considering, you probably don't like to acknowledge this, but insurance is a grudge purchase. Nobody likes to pay for something they may never use. Most of your clients are big companies. I think 80% of your client base is corporate. Are they cutting their cloth? Are they trimming back on insurances? Are they negotiating harder than ever before?
Bruce, you're right. It's difficult times for everyone, personal lines and actually our commercial clients, and everyone is trying to get the best possible price for their insurance. We also work hard with our clients to see how we can enable them to actually reduce the risk, therefore reducing the premium.
Because insurance is all about risk, isn't it? You determine what you can charge and whether or not you can make money after paying our claims. And, you know, short-term insurance risks are ever present. How do you then counsel people in terms of reducing risk? Because quite often reducing risk costs a whole bunch of money as well.
That's true, but I suppose that's where business owners must balance the fact whether they can invest now in something like a sprinkler system to reduce fire risk, or whether they want to have much higher insurance premiums, or in fact no insurance at all because the risk is uninsurable.
It becomes too expensive to do. Are you seeing a rise, and we often laugh about this, but it's no laughing matter, of cases of insurance fraud?
Bruce, no, we haven't seen a significant rise, and it is something that we watch out for carefully because, as you say, in difficult economic times, I think the temptation to commit fraud must just be much higher. But so far, we've been lucky and we haven't seen a big rise.
Yeah, because, it's easier to burn down a factory than make stuff sometimes, and not that we want to give anybody ideas, but it does happen. It's good to see the finance minister finally suggesting compulsory third-party insurance on motor cars. I've been sort of wondering for years why we don't have third-party insurance in a country where the road accident fund is bankrupt, in a country where we have such dreadful driving on the roads that we don't have a compulsory third-party insurance mechanism. But it looks like it may very well come.
Yes, it was a very welcome announcement from the minister around compulsory third-party motor insurance. It's something that, as an industry and as Santam, we support. But we don't really have any details other than what we heard in the budget announcement.
Yeah, but it would be a good thing, wouldn't it? Because it would spread risk across a far bigger pool of individuals. We'd all be then contributing to this risk pool, and should ultimately alleviate some of the pressure on the Road Accident Fund.
We agree, and that's why we support it.
Part of the premiums you collect are invested in markets. Last year served you well. We saw nice gains across the board. This year, with coronavirus adding huge amounts of uncertainty, it's a big risk for you because you take premiums, you then keep some in reserve to pay out as claims, and the rest you put away for a rainy day or a dry day, whichever day you put it away for in the insurance industry. Are you worried about the volatility we're seeing in markets right now?
We are, in fact, Bruce, a lot less exposed to the markets than we have been in the past. We've shifted some of our investments into more strategic investments, like the partnerships that we have with Sanlam. So we're a lot less exposed to the equity market. Our float investment is actually invested in interest-bearing investments. So we're not worried, but actually we're not as exposed as we have been in the past.
That's an interesting view. Then, as people whose job it is to calculate risk, you see markets simply as being too risky to invest in right now.
No, that was not the reason for the shift. It was really that we thought we can do in the long run, and this was really a medium to long-term decision, we can do better with the strategic investments in Africa than just investing in the South African equity market.
You did outline a new tech-driven strategy today. 5 years from now, do we see Santam looking a lot more like MyWay does today, 5 years from now?
On the personal lines side, yes, I do think we will deploy a lot more technology so that we can be more efficient and can deliver better service. On the commercial side, I don't think the change will be as pronounced.
And so, your brokers, I think, are waiting for the day when they're going to be told that they're not needed anymore. And that's obviously a risk you've got to manage, because you don't want to burn the brokers, who are your bread and butter, literally, in this industry.
Yeah, I mean, I firmly believe that there is a place for brokers in our industry, and that there will still be a place a number of years from now. The advice that they give in terms of risk mitigation, I think, is really key, and definitely so for your commercials, small commercials, and even your big commercials. So I think there will be a big role for them to play. I'm not too worried about the demise of brokers yet.
Yet. Nazeya Lambrecht, thank you, the Chief Executive of Suntime. Some really interesting points coming through this evening from Nazeya. In a moment, we're going to talk to Dr. Ryan Noach. He is at Discovery Health, all about what plans they're putting in place as Corona makes landfall in South Africa, about testing, about treatments, when it's necessary.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
Well, Dr. Ryan Noach standing by. We'll chat to him in just a moment. So far, according to Johns Hopkins University in the United States, 95,700 confirmed cases of coronavirus. Of those, 3,280 confirmed deaths. We got our first case of confirmed coronavirus in South Africa today. A traveller from Italy through Oro Tambo at the weekend to KZN. Dr. Ryan Noach is the Chief Executive of Discovery Health. Are you confident, Ryan, that we've got what it takes to contain the beast of corona?
Well, good evening, Bruce. As the Minister of Health recently said, I think any country's healthcare system is put under pressure by an epidemic of this proportion, and we're doing absolutely everything we can to prepare. I think our preparation and activity has been good, and it hopefully should not be too terribly tested, we hope.
Now, what are you guys doing in terms of helping to mitigate the worst effects of an outbreak?
We've taken quite a bold position, Bruce. We've assembled a large leadership team, and we've been doing nothing else really for the last 10 days or so. I think there are four key areas that we've been working in. The first is we think it's critically important for people to have all the facts at their fingertips. Education is central to remaining calm, understanding what's happening, and dealing with the obvious anxiety that emerges through this. So we've created an information hub on the Discovery website accessible to anyone in the public, to provide one source of updated factual information. We're concerned about some of the misinformation. In addition, all Discovery's health products, all lines of the health products, have, together with the support, very agile support of our regulator at the Council for Medical Schemes, we've extended those benefits to provide full cover from risk from Discovery Health's health product for all of the COVID-19 confirmed infections, and that includes the Discovery Health Medical Scheme product. The third area...
Ryan, this is critical. So no matter what plan you have with Discovery, no matter how little you pay in terms of premiums, COVID-19 in terms of testing, diagnosis, and whatever treatment is required is going to be covered. Do I understand that properly?
That's correct. On the Discovery Health Medical Scheme, we've quickly created a new benefit, something that typically takes months to do. We've done it this week with the support of the regulator. This benefit is called the World Health Organization Outbreak Benefit, and it will provide cover in any global health emergency like COVID-19 for confirmed cases in order to pay for diagnostic testing and to pay for all treatment, both in and out of hospital.
And how's that premium going to be covered? Because there's a spike in risk, and you guys employ teams of actuaries to calculate risk. How is that cost going to be apportioned?
This is very, very carefully being considered by the actuaries, who've looked at all the epidemic and outbreak data that is available globally to cost it. You know, schemes are mandated to have capital reserves and solvency reserves, as you well understand, Bruce. Those solvency reserves are there to support members in cases of crisis, And so we feel, and the trustees of the medical scheme felt very strongly, that at a time like this, this is the right time, if needed, to dig into the reserves. The Discovery Health Medical Scheme has 20 billion rand almost in cash reserves and is very liquid and financially capable of covering these costs without a problem.
So no additional premium costs then. And everybody with a Discovery medical product, whether it be what we broadly call a hospital plan or whether it be full-blown medical aid, is covered in the case of exposure to diagnosis of and treatment of COVID-19 or coronavirus, as we call it.
Yes, all Discovery Health medical scheme plans, from the low-income plans right to the executive plan, all covered on this benefit. And the benefit is active immediately. We had the paperwork finalized with the regulator yesterday afternoon, and everything is now in place. In addition, there are other Discovery Health products where we've extended cover as well. The primary care product provides a service to low-income, typically employed individuals, lower income, I should say. Many employers like to provide insurance products to their employees for health cover. And in the primary care product, which is an out-of-hospital product, we have extended the benefits to provide all out-of-hospital COVID-19 care, diagnosis and care for confirmed cases as well.
Thank you to Dr. Ryan Noach this evening, the Chief Executive of Discovery Health. And now, finally, you get to get an understanding, I suppose, of why those big reserves are there. For years, Discovery has been criticized for the scale of those reserves and the size of those reserves. Now you hit a potential medical emergency situation and suddenly that stuff starts to kick in. I'm sure the rest of the health insurance industry is going to follow. They don't have much choice, frankly. It's interesting. The World Health Organization benefit as a result of the outbreak of COVID-19. Here's the other side of it, of course, and they don't want you, the moment you go, oh, South Africans, we're so pathetic, you get a bit of a cold in winter, go, oh, I've got flu. Now this year you're going to get flu and you're going to go, oh, I've got coronavirus. You've got to go get yourself tested. In the case of sort of a misdiagnosis, in other words, you go in and you get tested, you are going to be charged. You are going to be charged for the test if you don't have the disease. But frankly, that's one bill I don't think many of us would mind paying.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives you expert solutions for your transactional banking needs. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. It's so funny watching people's reactions. They walk into studio and they don't want to get too close to the microphone because it's a microphone and people speak into microphones and And headphones are slightly gungy. We should interview our bosses about what they're doing to mitigate corona. It's a very real thing. I mean, we talk about hand washing and all sorts of stuff. I think it's a good thing that Discovery's doing. We'll get Warren's view on it in a moment in terms of to anybody who's got any kind of plan with Discovery to cover them for testing and for treatment. Because if you are taken out of circulation for a bit and you are very ill, and look, I mean, the fatality rates of this particular virus are not particularly high. Out of very significant numbers in the United States. I shared those with you earlier, about 3,000 and something deaths worldwide, 3,280 deaths worldwide out of about 100,000 cases. It's a mortality rate of about 3%, which is considerably lower than many other conditions around the world as well. Pavlo Fotidis, he's coming up at 7:30, as he does on a Thursday night. He's going to be talking about dealing to threats to your business from a whole bunch of risk issues. One of them will be corona. What happens if your staff get sick? What happens if your sudden workforce can't come in? What happens if you're a restaurateur? And suddenly, do you have a legal, I don't know if you have a legal obligation because you've got people doing contract work or even informal work, but people who work in restaurants don't generally get sick leave. And suddenly your staff gets sick. You can't have people turning up, you know, delivering plates of food who are not well or preparing plates of food who are not well. Your restaurant will quickly go out of business. So it's that sort of risk that suddenly you face in your small. And Warren Ingram's getting paler and paler. I'm wondering what's going on. Personal finance brought to you by Money Smart Week, creating a Money Smart South Africa. Visit mswsa.co.za. for more information. Why you look so nervous? What's so apprehensive? I mean, you're a fine figure of a man in fine shape and a pure picture of health.
That jet lag from Beijing is hectic.
No jokes, please. No jokes. This is no laughing matter. But we need to talk about investing in a world of coronavirus, because old Smugface over here was feeling very clever on Budget Day, because his money was processed into RA, into his retirement annuity, and was feeling very good that the budget was better than expected, and markets were stable on Budget Day after a bit of a sell-off on the day before. And then Thursday and Friday came, whack, whack, whack. And then with the recovery on Monday, then whack, whack, we've been whacked again. And it's just like, suddenly you don't feel so clever anymore.
No, it feels like you're suffering from whiplash, I guess, if you're watching market.
Whiplash is a good one,
markets, yeah. In big directions. I think the interesting thing about something like this is, I've been speaking to a few investors in the last few days, and just after the sort of whiplash started, and it's their psychology is fascinating, especially private investors, people that are not managing money on behalf of others, and they are most similar to what happened in 2008. It's the best sort of comparison I can find. Is South Africans are interesting. We look at a situation like that. It's something we have no control over. Very much in the purest form, an external unplanned event, very much like 2008. And we look at it and we say, okay, well, we can deal with volatility. There's nothing we can do actually much in this situation. The event has actually already happened from a market point of view. And let's bat it out. Let's just, batten on the hatches, see what's going to happen and carry on. And I think that's a really pragmatic attitude. Interesting to watch this, because we live through this. Our market is volatile, but I don't think it's nearly as volatile, for example, as the US market, moving up and down 5% in a day.
I haven't seen this sort of activity since 2008. I mean, this is proper fear stuff. There's even a fear index, and I'm sure the fear index is even scared.
It is, yeah, exactly, yeah, it's frozen. And so what's interesting for us is, I think we with our circumstances as a country and our history in the last sort of 10, 15 years, we look at this and we don't panic on the same scale as the Americans and the Europeans are doing. And I think that gives us quite an advantage, actually, when we start making, making investment decisions, or, for example, not making investment decisions, which is a decision all on its own. And I think that's the situation we're in now, is that we look at this and we say, well, these people in the developed world, they don't deal with a heck of a lot of volatility in their personal circumstances like we do on a daily basis. So when they have a threat of a virus that might kill 1-2% of the people that get infected, it sounds like a heck of a lot of people. But actually, I mean, that's quite small. I mean, my colleague said to me, why are you nervous about driving to the studio and sitting in the studio? Your chances of getting killed in a car accident are probably much higher on the way to the studio than getting sick from something in the studio. And that's a good point. We understand risk in a totally different way when it's personal risk.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when social media today was welcoming coronavirus in, saying, we hope you survive, basically. This is a tough place, Corona. Are you sure you picked the right fight? Whereas in other parts of the world, people are battening down the hatches and going to supermarkets and buying bottles of water and behaving like it's South Africa in 1994.
Yeah, and what's interesting is, anecdotal evidence, talking to people who've flown into South Africa in the last few days, that there's really heavy scanning, on the plane of every single passenger, and people are being checked very correctly, and so that's quite interesting. And I think there's a South African living, I can't remember his name now, in the UK, and he was saying he was screened really heavily flying into South Africa. On the way back to Heathrow, nothing. No screening, you went straight through. So that's interesting. I think whether we prepared on our borders on every single entry point, and when you swim across the Crocodile River, whatever it is, what's the one between here and Zim, you're probably not getting screened there. But the point is, we'll deal with this. And from an investment point of view, we can look through this stuff.
It was really funny. I mean, funny, strange to go through Oar Tambo this week, and people wearing rubber gloves and masks, but a lot of people getting really fed up with the face masks, so wearing them on their heads like hats. It was walking around with a slightly oversized yarmulke, running around the airport. And you go, hold on a second, if we are going to be serious about this, I mean, the airports company clearly is looking after people and is wanting to create the impression of having control. But that's the first moment I said my heart rate went up, going, okay. It's a bit like Philip, it's here.
It's arrived.
Yeah, it's arriving. We know it's coming.
So I think I think when I look at this, I always like to look at the world the way our favorite scenario planner looks at the world. Clem Sutton, and it's interesting because he's really
Had him on the show on Friday. If you missed Clem Sutton on this, it's worth picking up the podcast on it, because he said this was one of the flags, and he talks about flags about all kinds of issues, but a pandemic is a flag that he raised many years ago in one of his Fox books.
And I think he's now done. He's looked at this and he's put it into, so if that was the podcast from Friday, then and he's talking about this, I think one of the scenarios is that actually this is much ado about nothing, and so not saying that the virus doesn't hit South Africa, not saying that quite a few people get sick, but actually saying that it doesn't necessarily have a long-term structural impact on what goes on in the South African economy or even the global economy. And I think that that's really a way to look at this. It was interesting to me, for example, hearing Berkshire Hathaway, which Warren Buffett's company, buying up additional shares of Delta Airline. Now, I mean, you would imagine listed airlines around the world are being, and they are, being hit in this.
It's quite a big airline in one of Europe's biggest sort of regional airlines, Flybe, and they fly smaller aircraft, a bit like Aer Lingus does. It went bust today in the UK. It was already on its knees. It already had problems, just with a sudden drop off in air travel, it died today. It is a victim of coronavirus.
Their last straw.
Yeah.
And so I think, if someone like Warren Buffett, is looking at this and saying, well, he's always careful to deploy his cash and he doesn't do that quickly. And he's looking at this kind of a situation, and probably not him, because it's in the scale of things, such a small amount of money that they've deployed into this. But if they are, then it tells you something. And it's a view that I'm starting to share, which is this will have a structural change to the economy, for example, in things like supply chains. I think that this has woken the world up to the fact that we can't all have.
You can't put your factory just in one place, which is China. Yes.
Well, yeah, or that your entire supply chain, at some point, the link runs through China. So you might not have all your factories there, etc. But for example, if you're a big South African manufacturer of trucks, which we have one in South Africa, and you have certain parts which are made at $1 a piece in China, and your truck doesn't run without that $1 a piece, and now China's closed down, that's going to force a rethink of supply chains. And I think that's quite interesting. But I don't think that means it's a structural damage to the economy long term, we're at the end of time now. I think it's just a particular issue for now that we're going to have to look at. But I'm not saying end of the world now, and investments as we know it are over.
I found a fabulous graph today that was posted by Mduduzi Luthuli, who, if you don't follow him on Twitter, you should. At Trust Fund Zulu, he goes by the name of Trust Fund Zulu. Mduduzi Luthuli is a fund manager. He manages other people's money. Posted a graph today, and I want to take you through some of that graph and tell you what the end result is of that graph in a minute or two. Questions for Warren? Comments to make? 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567.
The Money Show. Personal finance.
There are often very good reasons to panic in markets. There are often very good reasons why people feel it is an opportune time to sell out of their investments and turn into cash and put their money into a safe bank account. So let me give you an example, or 100 examples quickly. In March 2009, this is the time of the global financial crisis, 663,000 jobs were lost in March in the US economy. That's huge. I mean, they've been creating jobs since then, but you didn't know that was going to happen. Chrysler and General Motors very soon after that filed for bankruptcy. Then there was the BP oil spill. Then there was a flash crash on US markets. Then the most powerful earthquake ever hit. The S&P downgraded US debt in September 2011, the fiscal cliff in the United States. Remember those discussions during the Obama years in November, December 2012. Cyprus then defaulted on its debt. There was a U.S. government shutdown in December 2013. The Ebola virus then hit in about December 2014, and people panicked, and there was a big dip in markets back then. There was the U.S. election for Donald Trump, of course, and there, the futures fell about 5% in a day. And then there was Brexit, and that caused markets to go backwards. Then the volatility index in about December 2017 hit massive highs. The Dow saw its biggest points decline ever in March 2018 of nearly 1,200 points. That was then the biggest decline ever. The S&P 500 entered a bear market in December 2018. Remember that? Everybody was thinking that this was the end. And then we have more recently, we've seen emergency funding coming into markets. We've seen trade wars. We've seen the inversion of the yield curve. So US debt dropped to below 1% and it's done it again. And now recently we've seen the coronavirus, and that's a big drop-off. It's very similar to the drop-off that we saw in December 2018, a very sharp pullback in the S&P 500. And Warren Ingram, I mean, each one of those was an individual reason why you would not stay invested in markets, because it's scary. And I mean, markets are volatile and frightening. But since March 2009 to about last week, how much had the S&P 500 gone up in 11, 12 years?
I actually don't know, but I mean, it must be well over 12% a year, somewhere around there.
But, okay, fine. Don't ask me to do maths, but it's up 431%.
Lots.
So the S&P, all the value of all of the companies on the S&P 500, America's 500 biggest companies, are four times more valuable today than they were in 2009. And had you sat on the sidelines at any one of those moments, you would have sat in cash and you would have grown at a much lower rate, certainly in the US with interest rates at 1% or 2%, than by staying invested in stock markets. And maybe that's the coronavirus lesson, or maybe this is the thing that leads to the end of the world. I don't know. But every single crisis seems like a huge crisis in its moment.
Well, and I think that's the intellect that you need to apply to markets. Is sometimes, as you said, there's a good reason to be cautious. I think there's probably never really a good time to panic when it comes to markets. I think, you know, lions and rhinos are often a good reason to panic, but not necessarily markets. And to me, this is one. This is the time when you should be saying, if there is no structural change to the way the world works, the way investment markets work, the way the economy works, then this is really one of those cliched buying opportunities. This isn't a time to be super fearful. And I think the core sort of reason, if I look at this, is we've already seen the US Federal Reserve doing what they can to help underpin the markets. In other words, they've cut interest rates, they're putting a lot of liquidity back in. I think it's probably now going to be, you know, not necessarily in total, but individual efforts on the same scale as 2008. We absolutely know the Chinese government will be doing something to stimulate their economy as well, and they'll take big steps. So in my view, I look at this and I say, well, once we've got a grip of the real impact of coronavirus, and maybe it's not as big as what the market initial reaction is telling us it's going to be, then the stimulus that's coming into the economy or to the global financial markets will unlock a totally different approach. In other words, people will look at that and say, well, now money's a lot cheaper for us to borrow and to put back into shares. Shares are a lot cheaper than they were. Everyone was fairly fearful of what was going on in the US stock market. And all of a sudden, there's been a bit of a shakeout. So maybe now they look at it and they say, well, now's the time to pile back in again. Because, yes, we don't want to buy government bonds in America. We certainly don't want to buy them in Europe. And we don't want to park our cash anywhere. Gold looks a bit expensive, and maybe the stock market is the place to go. And to me, I think that's kind of the signal here. I'm not saying necessarily that you pile in right now and sort of mortgage your house and put everything in there. But definitely the decision to sell shares in an environment like this, I think, is a terrible one. And certainly if you've been accumulating cash for some reason, then to start deploying that cash, I think, is a great call, gutsy call, but actually quite a logical, rational decision, and not one that you base on intuition, but sound reasoning.
And you've got to believe that markets do go up over time, and history shows us that markets go up over time until you start looking at graphs of the JSE of the last 5 years, and then you stop believing that story. And that's the problem, is that we look at global markets, we take our own biases living in South Africa, and we know the multitude of problems that exist here, and then we say, but then we can't put it into the JSE because it's just done nothing for 5 years. So we're going to put it into global markets, which are up 4 or 5 times in 10 years. That's not a smart decision either.
unless the froth has been taken out of global markets as a starting point. So in other words, that extra bit of overpricing is now done. And just to give you an idea, I was looking at the valuations of technology companies just before this all this fell apart. And their average price earnings ratio was around about 30. Quite high, but at the same time, I mean, they are growing their profits very well. There are actually a lot of them are paying dividends. There are about 34 of the big tech companies that actually pay dividends, and that value is not nearly as high as it was in the year 2000, just before the crash. That was around 43, the PE ratio of the tech companies, and very few of them were actually even making any money.
And that's the difference. Then these were a bunch of unicorns without horns. They were horses. They were donkeys, actually. And
a business plan, just really.
Yeah, and they were a lovely idea. This new internet thing's going to be big one day. We just don't know how to make money out of it, so let's list a whole bunch of stuff that doesn't make money. The survivors of that and their progeny are now massive real-world digital businesses.
Yeah, and I think that's the point in a situation like this is, you know, something like Microsoft, it's very hard to say that Microsoft is, you know, is just a business plan or a tech thing that's just going to be taken out tomorrow. I mean, many big businesses right now and small businesses can't really function without Microsoft. It's integral to their businesses right now. And that tells you that if its share price has gone down a bit and it's been paying dividends and it's extremely profitable, then when the share price goes down, maybe that's a time to buy. It's not the time to sell. Coming to the JSE, you know, if it's somewhere around that 52,000, nearly 53,000 level, and there are some good quality South African businesses that do operate globally, that's a good business case to follow, again, because their share prices have been knocked through no doing of their own. And I think it's a time to watch.
And then a signal sent, and I haven't seen the Reserve Bank Governor do this before, and maybe I've not looked this hard before, but he gave a speech at the University of the Free State, I think yesterday, and he's talking about the fact that South Africa needs structural reform. He always says that. He gets quite cross about the fact that it's so slow and that we're dragging our feet on this because we need to restructure the way the economy works. But he always says monetary policy is not a tool that we can use for sustainable fixes in the economy. You've got to fix the economy in order for it to work better. But here he says something quite interesting. He says, we can take the edge off with the interest rate tool, provided we have lower inflation, which we do, and if country risk comes down, which, depending on the discussions that government has with trade unions over the public sector wage bill, we can keep rates low and maybe go lower. I mean, this is a Reserve Bank governor giving a signal like I've not seen him give in a long time.
Well, let's give that a context. At the moment, interest rates in South Africa on South African bonds are out of the biggest economies in the world. Interest rates are the highest in the world for real interest rates. In other words, take the interest rate of the government, of the bond market, subtract the inflation rate. We sit in the place where you earn the highest real interest rate on your money anywhere in the world.
And there's a reason for that. It's a scary place to put your money if you're a Johnny Foreigner who's looking for a yield.
Well, you say that, but there are companies that are paying lower, countries that are paying lower interest rates that have been downgraded to junk that look way more scary than we do. Their economies are far less developed, et cetera, et cetera. So if you're looking at this and you're a global investor, and the moment this uncertainty is over and now you've been given a lot more money by your government's Federal Reserve, et cetera, et cetera, you're going to be saying to yourself, well, hang on, I can get myself a really nice yield on my money there. That's a signal. And I think the Reserve Bank has scope to cut interest rates by a heck of a lot before we become uncompetitive on interest rates. So I think that's a great signal. And I mean, to me, you know, that's nice for us as South Africans paying bonds, for example, paying mortgages. But for the rest, this is still a great place for people to get real good growth on their cash.
So if I can summarize the last 20 minutes of discussion, don't panic, be lekker.
Don't send your money out of the country at 15.30 or whatever it is, or 15.60 to the dollar. Now is not the time. Wait and be patient. This pendulum swings back.
Imagine just one financially literate person in a home can influence an entire generation, and you could be the one who brings financial literacy to the people. It's Money Smart Week from the 23rd to the 28th of this month, and as a registered South African business or NGO, or as a qualified financial expert with knowledge to share, you're invited to host a financial education event. Go to mswsa.co.za for more. Money Smart Week, creating a money smart South Africa.
The Money Show. Small business.
Pablo Fatidi is in a fighting moon. The small business feature brought to you by My Way. Get an obligation-free business insurance quote from My Way and you could win a billboard. My Way is a licensed insurer and FSP. T's and C's apply. Why are you fighting?
Bruce, before I fight, you've been busy.
So busy. No, we don't play. I play this game with you. You don't play this game.
No, you've been busy.
Don't play this game.
No, with you've been very busy.
Don't play this game with me.
That was amazing. It was busy.
It's been very busy.
So I'm going to fight tonight.
Okay.
I'm ready for it.
By the way, if you're wondering why we're having a little in-joke, because in-jokes don't really work for everybody else, just because I posted one or two videos of a book coming off a production line, that's what he's playing with, and the book will be available. And if you follow me on social media, you'll know exactly when the launches are and fabulous things like that. But yes, at least I didn't have to go and beg for a title.
But you were busy.
So busy.
I offered some in any event.
You did. Mine was better. So why are you fighting?
Okay, so Bruce, it's been quite a interesting 2-3 days. Through 6 or 7 events, I have spoken to about 1,800 business owners, the smallest of which does around 65,000 rand a year of annual revenues. 65,000 rand.
Okay.
Coming out of townships in Khayelitsha, I spoke to someone who has a real understanding of that environment, and it was terrifying. And the largest of which does about 650 million odd rand as a fourth generation business. So the scope and the range was quite remarkable. And through it, the issues that are out there that aren't being addressed, the issues that should be very comfortably addressed by the state in order to create...
This special small business department?
No, right across the board.
Okay.
Right across the board. I was just left horrified. I've got answers for some of them. One of them I don't have an answer for. But tonight's got to be the night that we have the fight around it. And with all these events, what is the natural instinct? You go up, you meet people, you talk with people, you engage with people, and the first thing you want to do as a South African is you put your hand out to shake someone's hand.
Achoo.
It was terrifying.
I was on the stage today, and I didn't shake anybody's hand. It was like waving hello, toe tapping. I mean, making light of corona, but it's one of the big risks, of course.
We have to stop shaking hands, and it's not an offense. It's absolutely necessary. So how do you greet then? Well, I've been doing elbow greets, not even a fist bump because they're skin touching.
Yeah.
Toe taps, looking in the eye meaningfully and giving a nod and a bow. And the only way I could actually stop doing the handshakes was to put things in my hands so I could stop that instinct.
But people are
so
friendly. You like people. People come up to you. They want to chat. So Joanne Joseph earlier said, yeah, my people have done this for 6,000 years. You put your hands together, you go, namaste.
Namaste. And you look and you bow slightly.
Absolutely. It's a sign of deep respect.
Mm. Yeah. Well, we have to start thinking about it.
We do.
But it also left me with a very, very interesting thought around what can it do to a brand if you make bad decisions around it? Because right now, it remains more of an unknown than a known. Right now, it seems pretty clear to me that the United States has no response to this that's meaningful, that will be able to contain it. Right now, with only 2,500 testing kits moving into Washington for a population of how many people, I think we're going to have a lot of trouble coming down the pipe. And I was thinking about the Cape Argus event, which is taking place this weekend. And I was looking especially at where the coronavirus was seemingly emanating from. And Italy has been incredibly hard hit. And Bruce, last time I looked, the Italians love cycling. And they're good cyclists. And they're avid cyclists. And they've got some incredible cycling brands. And I would love to hear from the organizers of the Cape Argus. How do you
make
a call?
Cape Town Cycle Tour.
Cape Town Cycle Tour. How do you make a call? As to whether that's a responsible thing to do or not.
Tim Ferriss, who you will know about, he's one of these guys who does long interviews. He's no longer going to South by Southwest, which is a huge event in Austin and Texas. And he's saying these guys must cancel this event. I think it's going ahead, but it's drawing a lot of opposition.
Completely. But there are going to be some real opportunities with it. So one of the opportunities that I definitely see is I see China surging ahead in digital engagement and communications. Most people now are working through screens and you're going to start developing efficiencies around it. You're going to start understanding how to work through a screen effectively, how to get impact in conversations, how to reach agreement, how to organize conversations, how to present yourself in the screen so that you can have the best possible engagement with someone. I think we're going to see a massive increase in the sale of screens, in bandwidth consumption, in all the tools and devices that allow you to engage through screens. I think we should be investing in Zoom and Skype and all those, let's call them softwares, that allow us to actually engage with each other, because they must be going through an absolute record period at the moment in China. And it's sure to come here too.
So what is your rage around coronavirus? I mean, just the fact that we don't seem to have a real plan to tackle it. I mean, I was chatting to Sim Chabalala about it earlier now and saying, yeah, they've seen their business in China. They've had to quarantine people. They've had to make people work remotely from home. And it's so far on a small scale is working fine.
Yeah, on a small scale, it is working fine. But the fact of the matter, does anyone believe anyone when they say we've got it under control? Because no one truly understands it. The quarantine period was 2 weeks. It now looks to be 3 weeks, and there's still no vaccines in sight. You've heard of vaccines coming out of Israel. You've heard of vaccines coming out of the West Coast of the United States. So there's lots of hoo-ha around everything. But the truth of the matter is most people who are responsible for managing our well-being globally in this space don't seem to be the right people. Because all I hear coming out of the States is, what is Mike Pence doing leading this when they have got some of the top experts in the world around virology? Where are they?
Opportunity. So in times of crisis, opportunity often presents itself. So Mudimowa Maths on Twitter says, please ask Pablo what he thinks about starting either a delivery business or an online business for supplying basic household needs. Since if coronavirus intensifies, people will go and hide indoors. They'll be scared to go out and buy basic needs. We've already got online shopping to do that. Are there more opportunities?
I don't think there are, and I'll tell you why. You know, the launch of this new service from, I think it's ShopRite Checkers that I've been seeing. I haven't tested it. I haven't tried it myself.
So a colleague of mine did it, and was delivery in half an hour, Tikiso? Was it in half an hour? No delivery, you did that order within 60 minutes? It was like 16... He did it this evening in under 60 minutes. So it's functioning. We haven't yet had the negative PR when it gets too popular and it doesn't work, but he sort of just did it this evening, yeah.
Oh, maybe it's just absolutely fortuitous timing. Isn't that, they call that serendipity, I think.
I think they did.
I think they do.
Okay, so now, tell me please then about crime, because crime is such a fundamental issue, and this is the real cut and thrust of crime. I mean, we see the reports coming through in Massmart results. They're very vulnerable. ShopRite, ShopRite are very conveniently located, not only for shoppers, but for criminals. And we see these dreadful videos that people like Yusuf Abramji post to raise awareness of people who work in these stores deeply traumatized, lying face down as these guys walk in with AK-47s into stores with gay abandon. Because, you know, you can't have your security guys everywhere all the time.
And Bruce, you know, that's what we see. We see that, and a lot of these stores, a lot of those organizations, thank heavens, can afford insurance. I heard you speaking a little bit earlier in the show around insurance and the necessity to protect yourself. But the part that really upset me, and it upset me deeply yesterday, I was speaking to Luvuyo Rani, who's a co-founder at Silulo Uluto Technologies. They establish, let's call them incubators in township areas. And he asked me a question, and it's a question that left me completely stumped. He turned around and he said, these survivalist business owners in township areas, the people who are making 50, 60,000 rand in revenues a year, so 3,000-4,000 rand a month, that's barely survivalist, are being racketeered by groups of mafia crowds who go, and in order for you to trade, you need to pay 10 bucks, 50 bucks, whatever it might be in the day. They have attempted to work with the police. The police have not done anything nor achieved anything. And he said, how do you talk to them around how they can actually prevent this, avoid it, or build a business within that environment? And Bruce, for the first time, I was left with an outcome that says there's nothing to do. They are unspoken, they have no voice, no one pays attention to them, and these are folk who, as I understand it, are absolutely desperate, right at the edge of their existence. They're still trying to get something together, do the basics to put a little bit of food on the table, and in that environment, there's absolutely no service from the state, the police, the environment, call it who you will, in order to provide some form of protection. I do not see a strategy for them at all.
No, there isn't. I mean, so the big supermarkets, I mentioned them, but township entrepreneurs in Cape Town, the people you've been talking to, manufacturers in Gauteng are being treated like punchbags.
Yeah, they have been. And, you know, we saw a lot of it happening in 2018 where big manufacturers were being racketeered down by groups of people. I know that they went the political route. It failed. Either the EFF was fighting with the DA or the DA was fighting with the ANC. So all the ward councillors of the various political parties, they were there in voice, but no action at all. I know that a lot of them went through the South African Police Services. They went to the Johannesburg municipality. They went through to the mayor at the time. Nothing of any impact was done to protect these businesses. Most of them paid the bribes. They paid what they had to pay in order to get rid of the problem. And Bruce, today they're still paying.
The trouble with that is once you pay one bribe, you've shown a willingness to do it.
Completely. It doesn't stop. It doesn't stop.
Let's pick up on that more in a moment. Pablo Fatidi's angry at the moment. It's good to get Pablo angry because that way you get results. But more with him in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives you expert solutions for your transactional banking needs. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. The Money Show. Small business.
Running a small business is hard enough at the best of times. Even when things are good, it's difficult. But in a world of coronavirus, in a world where crime is so central to our daily lives, then you've got the issue of competition in South Africa, and if there is a playing field, it's sort of tilted at 85 degrees. It's not level at all.
Look, what brought that up for me today is I had a really interesting conversation with a guy who runs a business in a township as well at a big event that took place here this morning in Johannesburg, and he turned around and he said to me, "It's unfair." I said, "What's unfair?" He said, "One of the big supermarket brands is constantly attacking my market opportunity." I said, "What do you mean?" And what he does is he makes loaves of bread.
It's not. Does he know it's not his market opportunity? It's a market opportunity.
It's a market opportunity. Yeah. And he was complaining about the fact that competition's unfair because this big supermarket chain has buying power and capabilities to always outprice. And we had an interesting debate because I could see he was agitated and annoyed. And I turned around and I said to him, "But really, is it then perhaps the consumer is saying they prefer a cheaper cost article? They are choosing to make decisions freely, independently, with their feet and with their pockets." And then he said, "But how do I compete as a small business against this enormous supermarket brand?" And I said, "Well, that's where perhaps the difference has to be. Because you need to do things that they, for example, can't do." Like what he said. And Bruce, here's my point. Here's my point about not trying to fight product with product. Here's my point about saying, who do I serve? It might not be everyone, and it should not be everyone, but if it is a good niche, and I can do what they can't do, I have an opportunity. For example, there might well be people, aged people, who don't have the mobility or capability to move towards these big shopping centers and buy this super cheap bread. He might be able to do deliveries to their homes within township areas. He might be able to fortify that bread in order to give it more vitamins and minerals. He might be able to put syrup in the bread and give it a distinctive flavor and taste. The mere fact that you're competing now for a different piece of the market, someone who wants something slightly differently and is prepared to pay for it because they enjoy the value they get for it, that's how you compete with the super big giants out there.
Yeah, it's a really difficult one because these guys often, and we've seen the Competition Commission come down really hard on them, but I think they do it very quietly and surreptitiously anyway. The big bakers will move heaven and earth to undercut the small bakers. And I have a family member who was in the baking business for years and struggled against the big guys because no matter what he did, the big guys would find a way to undercut, and they were trying to outlast. He outlasted them, but it's a difficult sector to be in. You've got to differentiate. You can't be producing sort of what the old fashioned government white loaf of 800 grams or whatever it is, and think that you can do it cheaper at a different price point and still make money than the big guys, because they're going to outlast you
completely. And I do not for one minute believe This was located in a very big township in Gauteng. I do not for 1 minute believe that everybody wants the same thing in the same way. I do think that
price is important, though.
Price is important, but if you add value to a product and you enrich it and you give it something more useful, in other words, slice for slice, I carry twice the calorific value.
Slice for slice, it's twice as nice.
There we go.
You can have that for nothing. Injustice. In that book that you were talking about earlier, I talk about South Africa's unfair economy.
Mm.
And it is an unfair economy.
It is an unfair economy. But Bruce, I'll tell you what's particularly unfair. Tumamina. Remember, 2018.
I remember. The Ramaphosa days.
Yes, the Ramaphosa days. The rule of law has come back. We were told that in the SONA address. We all need to go out there and build South Africa. And Bruce, there's not one person I know who did not buy into that.
Well, you want to believe.
You want to believe it.
Yeah.
And a couple of entrepreneurs that I was speaking with down in the Cape Town area were talking to me about the impact of government's failure to produce reliable, cost-effective electricity. When they made the investment in their businesses, they did it on the basis that we would get our electricity supply fixed, because we were told we as the state will do our bit, you as business do your bit.
However, and again, this is a question of how long you can last. In an environment, there's been 10 days of no load shedding, so woohoo. And Eskom's done its job for 10 days. But you know, the Western Cape is at the forefront of buying power from IPPs. They're going to get the right to do that, and that mechanism is going to come in place, because solvent municipalities are going to do this because actually it's a crisis situation and they have to resolve this problem. So there is a plan. It's just, can you last as long as the plan takes to implement?
So I read a very, very interesting interview between an energy expert, a well-known...
Chris Yelland.
And Minister Gwede Mantashe.
Right.
And Chris was attempting to try and understand how the minister was thinking about things. And Chris mentioned at some point in the interview, he said, but Minister, we're in a panic around this. And Gwede Mantashe went on to explain that he came out of the mining sector, and in the mining sector, where things are dangerous and things can go wrong, you learn not to panic, because if you panic, you can die. And Bruce, it got me thinking that here as business, speaking to business owners who are dying literally every day because of issues around electricity, especially in the manufacturing industrial landscape of our country, we had a minister who went then on to say, you need to get perspective. You need to understand the facts. You need to weigh up on the left and then on the right. And then you need to step back and take perspective again. And he said, good decisions here are made with a calm mind. And that was said by somebody who only eats. He does not produce income for the country. The people producing the income are the people who are burning right now.
And they're crying, they're begging for help.
Mm. So
and
got me,
and it's not being heard. Last point.
You can help me understand this. What is a social compact? What is a social contract between citizens or society and a state? What should we expect? And when it's not offered back to us, how should we behave, Bruce? I wait to hear.
Oh, is that the time?